Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our luncheon today, Typhoon Haiyan, Behind the Lens, Beyond the Headlines, covering the story. My name is Angie Lau. I'm the anchor at Bloomberg Television Mornings. I'm also very privileged and honored to be in my second term as correspondent board member. And I'm joined today by Florence de Changy, who is a fellow correspondent board member, as is Keith Bradshaw, who's joining us in a different capacity today. But before I start with the introductions, I want to just some house rules here. If we could just turn off any cell phones, maybe put it to vibrate. And of course, if you could check out our website, www.fcchk.org, we have a lot of events upcoming, including Italian Wine Social and a wall exhibition on Thursdays and all the rest. So do check it out, because amongst those many events are gems, and I consider today to be one of those. Today's panel really came about during a conversation that we had at the professional committee meeting last month, really. And thinking about just what made FCC different. And I think that the people that you see at our head table today defines that to a T. This panel marks the 3-month anniversary of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. Now, CNN's Christy Lou Stout and New York Times' Keith Bradshaw's work truly emerged as just only some of the most engaging and gripping coverage of the disaster from journalists in this region. Florence was there as well. Many of our correspondent journalists from Hong Kong sped into the center of the disaster. Today, we are grateful for Christy Lou Stout and Keith Bradshaw's time and this very rare behind-the-scenes look at the incredible work of our foreign correspondents in the field as they struggle to bring to light the stories of the victims of Typhoon Haiyan. Their work really stood out. It was incredible, and we're excited to introduce them to you today. Let me start with Keith Bradshaw. He is New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning chief, Hong Kong bureau chief, reporting on Greater China and, of course, this region. In the immediate aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan, Keith and his colleagues rushed into the heart of the chaos. His reporting of the days that followed were the most heartbreaking, stories of victims who died of simple injuries, including a man with a broken leg. Christy Lou Stout is an award-winning anchor and correspondent for CNN International. She's the host of the daily news program Newsstream and CNN's monthly show On China. Now, Christy has led coverage of major breaking news stories for the network, and most recently in the Philippines, covering Super Typhoon Haiyan. That's where Christy and dozens of her CNN colleagues based themselves in Tacloban, Cebu, and Manila for over 10 days. And I'd like to invite her here first to give her firsthand account of what really happened during the worst storm ever recorded.
Angie, thank you very much indeed for that introduction. I'm gonna fire up my PowerPoint presentation here. And also just wanna start with a note of gratitude. Thank you to everyone in this room and for giving me the opportunity to speak today. When I'm live on air, I'm usually addressing a black-eyed camera. I'm addressing equipment. So for me to talk to a live audience of real people is a special treat for me, especially if it's an audience made up of fellow journalists and fellow members of the Foreign Correspondents Club. So thank you very much indeed for that. Now, when I look back and I think about the events that took place around Super Typhoon Haiyan, I have to admit one image comes to mind, and it's this image. It's an image from space that was tweeted out and sent by the American astronaut Karen Nyberg when she was on board the International Space Station. I feel that's an image that perfectly encapsulates the sheer power and force of the storm. Now, in numeric terms, you can talk about the force of this storm, one of the strongest ever on record. You can imagine it this way. A commercial jet takes off at speeds around 260 kilometers per hour. This typhoon was stronger than that. And it was because of the force of this storm, it resulted in very deadly wind damage, and of course the deadly storm surge that was widely reported. It generated this up to 5 meter tall wave of water that roared ashore, wiping out entire communities. This is a photograph that all of us are all too familiar with, of the aftermath of the super typhoon, the scene in Tacloban immediately afterwards. In the end, 6,000 people were killed and 3.9 million people were displaced. Now, when the storm roared ashore, we had a correspondent on the ground there already. CNN was the only news organization that had an international correspondent. That was Andrew Stevens, who was in Tacloban City with his crew. And they were there in the epicenter, and they were able to witness what happened during the storm as it made landfall. After it made landfall, we lost communications with him and his crew. And it was a very scary time. It wasn't until, and I was talking to Andrew's producer, Tim Schwartz, it wasn't until over 24 hours later when they were able to just borrow a cell phone from a relief worker and to make that proof of life phone call, to call into CNN to say, please tell our families we're okay. Immediately after the show wrapped, my show on Friday night, I was told by the network to go home, pack my bags, leave as soon as you can to get yourself to Manila. I arrived in Manila on Saturday morning. That was still before we were able to get in contact with Andrew Stevens, let alone activate the team there in Tacloban City. And I immediately set to work issuing hourly and every half hour updates about what we knew, what was unfolding that day in the aftermath of the storm. And I'll never forget when we got the first significant death toll number. Someone had radioed in from the Tacloban City Airport to the Philippine Civil Aviation Authority, saying that they had seen 100 bodies on the streets of Tacloban. Tacloban City is a city of about 200,000 residents, and we knew that the death toll was just going to climb higher, and certainly it did. About 48 hours after the storm made landfall, we started to get aerial imagery of the devastation. This photo here was taken by my colleague Ivan Watson, who was on board an aircraft with the Philippine Civil Aviation Authority. You can see the ships washed up on the shore, this in Tacloban. And the scenes there just made everyone just think about what happened in 2004. It really evoked the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, the force of the tsunami, the force of the storm surge. It was also over 48 hours later when Paula Hancox, my colleague who's usually based out of Seoul, she and her crew managed to get into Tacloban City, and she became the first international correspondent to report live from Tacloban City. And here she is in Tacloban City Airport. From there, she reported about the survivors, caring all they could from their devastated lives, a steady stream of high-end survivors. They keep arriving here. They're looking for food. They're looking for water. They're looking for escape. This is a photograph of her, along with cameraman Paul Devitt and a local fixer. And where they are right now, that's where CNN was based in Tacloban City. It was this battered shell of the Tacloban City Airport. And that is where they worked, and that is where they slept. Andrew Stevens, shortly after we were able to get in contact with him and we were able to get broadcast equipment to him and his team, he started filing his reports from Tacloban City, including really just an incredible account of what it was like to be in the epicenter of the storm as it made landfall. You can see in the bottom left and this bottom right on the screen, there's a screen capture of one part of his story where it shows he and his crew scrambling to save a family. They were at the same hotel. They were struggling against the rising water, the storm surge, and helped the family, which included a disabled daughter, to reach higher ground, to reach safety. And Andrew, in his account, talking about what it was like to be basically just battening down the hatches in the hotel, experiencing this scary storm. He said, as we walked outside, it was immediately clear that so much of the city has suffered so much more than we had. Now, I have to admit, based in Manila, I was waiting for my call to get in and to go to Leyte or to go to Samar and to participate in the coverage. That didn't happen. The network said that they were very happy with my coverage and my reporting from Manila. I have to admit, I was disappointed, but only for half a second, because the story was not about me. I mean, it was about the fate of millions of displaced people, right? And so at that moment, I resolved to do two things. Number one, from Manila, to help center the coverage, to take in the various feeds of information coming in from relief agencies, from our correspondents, my colleagues on the ground, from the US government, the Philippines government, from various news sources, including the New York Times and Keith's reporting, from social media, to compile it and to present it in a timely and compelling way. And I also vowed to do another thing, which was to always keep the focus on the survivors. This is Jubalin Tanyega. A CNN crew led by Anderson Cooper found her in Tacloban City. She was crouched among the rubble of what was her home. And it was there she had last seen her husband and her six children. And she told CNN, "I really want to see them, even though if it's just their bodies." And in the back of my mind, as surely as in the back of every correspondent's mind at CNN, we kept the focus on her and the millions of displaced people in the storm zone during our coverage. And that, just to encapsulate that, I brought that tone out on air and also online. For example, in this tweet that I sent out, 5 days since Haiyan hit, 5 days has got to be the limit for people to withstand thirst, hunger, injuries. The pace of relief must pick up now. So just trying to show you that as a reporter and as a correspondent and anchor, trying to get the audience to really experience the perspective from the survivors, from the people who were still waiting for that help to arrive. Now, in the weeks and months after Super Typhoon Haiyan, there have been a lot of discussion about the lessons learned here. I think there are probably two main lessons in terms of dealing with a disaster. Number one, there needs to be more awareness. I mean, it was absolutely stunning that even Tacloban City officials had no idea of the danger of the storm, let alone the danger of the storm surge. Even though, I mean, I remember Amari Ramos, our CNN Weather Center anchor, was reporting the days leading up to the storm, warning everyone about the danger of the storm surge. The warnings are out there. The awareness wasn't. Another lesson was access. Every single relief agency or relief worker I talked to, whether it was Catholic Relief Services or UNICEF or Red Cross, what have you, always bemoaned the lack of access. There was just not enough helicopter lift, not enough military cargo lift, not enough roads that were passable, not enough working runways. But in terms of journalists and journalism, our craft, what are the lessons learned here? Well, from CNN's perspective, number one, have a 24-hour operation away from the epicenter. For us, that was Manila. And by having that operation Manila, that gave us a guarantee that we could offer a constant live presence, which was very important, especially in the first 24 and 48 hours after the storm hit. And what we've learned since then from talking to people at the US military or the World Bank, relief agencies, they're watching CNN and they're trying to figure out what their response should be. And the first 24 to 48 hours, that's very critical when we were waiting to activate our teams in Tacloban City, or when those Tacloban City colleagues were not ready to go on air because of a power generator issue, what have you, at least we could still power and keep the story on thanks to the Manila operation. And a shout out to Elizabeth Joseph, who was also with me there in Manila. We worked together 2 a.m., 3 a.m. in the morning, multiple days in a row. Also have epic engineers. I have to say, CNN, we have epic engineers. They are our unsung heroes. I think maybe in the future, the FCC should do a panel about the technical geniuses behind journalism. They got us to air. They can get us to air anywhere. And it's incredible what they were able to do to get a 650-kilogram satellite dish to Tacloban City with three generators. In the end, it was two generators because they ended up giving one generator away to a church looking after orphan children. They are absolutely amazing. From our post in Manila, we had three live feeds going on at the same time and without a hitch. And I'll never forget one, I think it was like a midnight live update I was doing. It started to rain. We lost the BGAN connection, which is the broadband satellite that we use. And Richard Stokes, one of our engineers, within 10 minutes and without breaking a sweat, put up a tarp, fixed the BGAN connection, and offered me a glass of water. These guys are amazing. And don't forget the survivors. And I think this is what really made a lot of, I think, I'll just say, I'm really proud of CNN's reporting and what we did for Haiyan. I think it was because as a team, we always kept the focus on the survivors. And you have to keep the focus on them, especially, you know, even after the emergency relief work is done. there is the long-term effort of recovery and rebuilding. Now, CNN, we will continue to be fixed on the story. In fact, plans are in the works right now for us to return. We will go back. We will continue to keep tabs on the story. I know Keith is just there in Tacloban and City, one of many trips he's done since the storm made landfall there. I'll leave it at that so I can hand things over to Keith. Thank you very much indeed.
Let me quickly change this here. Thank you all very much for coming. Typhoon Haiyan was a terrible tragedy for the people in the Philippines. 4 million people had their homes severely damaged or destroyed. More than 6,000 dead, according to the official tally. The true tally, there's a lot of evidence, is actually even higher. Nearly 2,000 people missing. Now, one of those numbers should stand out to you. 4 million people losing their homes. The Indonesian tsunami was 1.7 million. Why did this storm do so much more damage? And the answer is the Indonesian tsunami, or the Indian Ocean tsunami, destroyed a 1 mile wide coastal strip down the side of Sumatra, which is an island the size of California. And then it also did a lot of damage in Sri Lanka and along some of the Indian coastline. What was different about Typhoon Haiyan was the depth from the coastline at which you had enormous damage. In the case of Typhoon Haiyan, practically all of Leyte Island, which is the size of Delaware, was flattened. That's 1.5 million people. Samar Island, badly damaged as well. Panay, a half dozen other islands, all badly damaged. That's how you end up with this enormous devastation. It also had an effect on coverage. It was very hard to find anything. In the case of the Indonesian tsunami, you could go a mile and a half inland, and everything was fine. You had an area the size of California that could put supplies into the area that had been damaged and places for reporters to live, get food and water. You had none of that in Leyte. And so the situation for relief workers and for the journalists was really, really challenging in terms of logistics. To give you an idea of how difficult it was, nobody even tried to sell food on the streets or water for a week. Normally, there's some kind of market response, and you really ended up in a situation where it didn't matter how much money somebody had or anything. You could not find anybody who would surrender anything because they didn't know where their next little bottle of water was going to come from. For gasoline, for example, you need gasoline if you want to cover more than a short distance. We were not able to find any gasoline until day 7 after the typhoon, when we were able to buy some in plastic bottles from people who'd managed to scavenge it. And even then, guess what we paid? $10 a liter, $38 a gallon. And we got 7.5 gallons. And that was by buying up a bunch of plastic bottles of gasoline that had become available finally a week later. So food, water, gasoline, all were very tough. Part of the reason was that there was a lot of looting. Then shop owners, and gas station owners for that matter, didn't hid their remaining supplies. None of the gas station owners wanted to reopen for fear that they would be looted. So what increased the sense of insecurity was you only had a couple thousand soldiers moving into an area with millions of people who'd lost their homes. Almost everybody also, because of the smell of rotting bodies, was using bandanas over their faces. So you couldn't tell whether somebody was doing so because of the smell or because they were a possible looter. For example, I was walking back one day to the hotel, and coincidentally, I'd also been given the sat phones by two of our photographers, so I was carrying an extra bag of gear, and a half dozen youths in bandanas came up to me in a deserted area with a lot of debris and so forth and said, "Do you have any cameras for us or whatever?" And I just smiled, chatted, kept walking, and they didn't try to do anything forcible, and I didn't lose anything. But it was sort of an awkward situation that made some people a little bit nervous. One of the concerns was looters. One of the stories I didn't put in, couldn't find a home for in print because it was a difficult story to tell, was I went into the interior of Leyte Island, actually right after we got the gasoline, in order to see what conditions were like there. Because at that time there were 62 foreign medical groups by then, 8 days later, all within a couple miles of the coast. And when I went even 3 miles inland, I found hundreds of people with untreated injuries, no medical supplies, no doctors whatsoever. And in fact, my editors put the story up immediately on the web, and within 4 hours, there were even already medical groups going into those areas. So people did, there were aid groups looking for information that didn't have any. But the in the interior, we went deep into the interior, and we were at one point, because I was looking actually for the family, the widow of somebody whom I'd interviewed as they were dying and not receiving any medical care, and I'd really wanted to talk to the widow because she had not been there as her husband was dying. And so I tried to find them, and I went deep into the interior, and an hour on dirt roads after the last paved road, and as we were coming out through various villages, we stopped at one where there was a woman who 3 out of the 4 walls of her house had been destroyed by different falling trees. That's how many coconut trees were blowing over. And she talked about how she was cradling a baby. This is not somebody I ever quoted. And she said that her husband was missing, not been reported. And she had not reported. So I thought, okay, that'll be a story on missing persons and how a lot of these cases are not reported. And I said, well, where was he last? He was in Tacloban, and he had been visiting family. And she did give me the address of the family. So I went there to find the family. And the family said, oh, no, that's not the story at all. In fact, an escaped convict had gotten a gun after he had gotten out of prison and had gone and had a romantic relationship with the young woman and had chased off the husband in the jungle, and he had left, and they said, oh, the convict with the gun must have been hiding behind the remains of the house as you were talking to her. And I couldn't, we decided that it was not safe to go into the jungle again asking for this armed convict in a chaotic situation with no police, so we were not able to get a further comment, and therefore we did not write that particular missing person story. It was an example of the chaos that you had. Getting supplies in, another story, it was really difficult. After a week, we got down to the point where we drunk all the water that we'd been able to bring in, even though we'd brought in a couple of, Tyler Hicks had brought in a couple of 5-gallon jugs, we were drinking the water from our canned peas. By the time we finally received a van load of supplies that Andy Jacobs had managed to arrange in Cebu. And Andy did a great job. The question, who do you get to drive a van load of whatever 50 gallons of gasoline and jerry cans sitting in the seat in the place where they'd taken the seats out of the back of the van, and a lot of water and food, and you need somebody who's going to take that on a several hour ferry ride and then drive that through 100 kilometers of turmoil and down trees. Andy got just the people. 2 bikers with shaved heads. They looked great. They were just the people for this kind of a task. And they loved to tell everybody with a laugh that we look scarier than anybody else we'd meet on the road, so nobody bothered us. So we were able to get supplies in after a week, and they also brought a gasoline generator. Up until then, we'd been having to beg time on other people's generators, usually the military, City Hall, and so forth. I was very fortunate to have an amazing team with me there. On the first day that I flew in, I was on the second propeller plane to land that morning when they reopened the airport. I tried to get onto the military plane, then they didn't let us on the military plane, so I didn't get onto the first propeller plane, so I got on the one after that. So I was on the second plane in. And Jess Asnar was with me, along with Robert Gonzaga, who was the fixer helping out on this. Both spoke Tagalog, terrific people. We slept the first night on broken pieces of plasterboard at the airport. I was under the lee of the roof of a broken, really destroyed concrete building. The tropical depression came through, so the rain was blowing very hard. But fortunately, I was on the downwind side, and we didn't get wet. The next day, next person to come in, Tyler Hicks, one of the world's most famous combat photographers, terrific journalist, 18 years covering the Bosnian War, the Iraq War living in Baghdad, Afghanistan, kidnapped and eventually released in Libya, in and out of Syria in the last couple of years. You name it, he is used to really difficult conditions. He took some of these pictures. Let me scroll through some of these. This is somebody, as I mentioned, with a bandana. This is going into downtown Tacloban. Tyler managed to persuade somebody who had a flight out on a relief plane, who had a covered pickup truck with an empty tank of gasoline, managed to persuade him that we could rent his light-duty vehicle so that we could drive into the city. And so it really was running on fumes. And that drive into the city, we were among the first to reach the really downtown hard-hit areas. And it was one of the most horrifying things I've ever seen. Just so many bodies, mile after mile, drowned bodies along the side of the road, no effort to try to put them away. And it was right near here, actually about 50 yards over from this scene, that there was a particularly sad scene. There was a man who had a piece of plywood about this big, and he wrote on it, I will be back at 5 p.m., and then he wrote with a big blue magic marker, Michelle, with an arrow, and I think Mark, with an arrow, for the other one, and he picked up the plywood and put it between two bodies, and we asked him, and he said, well, this is my wife, and this is my 7-year-old, and I can't stay with them any longer. I have no food or water, but I don't want them to end up in an unmarked grave, and I have to flee the city. Interestingly, I later found out from municipal workers that they were not able to find him. They weren't able to figure out the last names, and those bodies did end up in an unmarked grave. But that drive in, I mean, we kept thinking we were going to run out of gasoline. We were just sort of zigzagging through all of this debris. We eventually reached a hotel that was less damaged, had no running water, no drinking water, no food. Periodically, you had little pieces of the roof falling down on the ground, so you had to be careful where you stood around the edges of the roof. My room reeked as though somebody had died in it, but they said nobody had. But it was, and so I would sit outdoors and write my stories by moonlight, because then you can turn down your screen a lot, and that saves electricity, because there was always a question where we were going to get our next recharge. There were so few generators even in the early days. And I'd turn on my flashlight, of course, to check spellings and quotes all in my notebook. So this was on the way in, and so many people coming out of the city, almost nobody was going in during this drive, and a lot of them bandaged or having other difficulties. So this is sort of the beginning after leaving the airport where we'd initially been staying. And this is these are some of the scenes of just how flattened everything was. So it was a combination of the storm surge, which was tsunami-like, and the wind damage. To give you an idea on the storm surge, I was talking a week before last on my fourth trip to Tacloban to the people at Leeco, which is the local electric utility. They have found places that were submerged as they're looking at all these buildings that were 25 feet above sea level. So the storm surge was much greater than we initially realized. Leeco had some interesting numbers. They were serving 57,000 buildings in Tacloban and two adjacent communities before the storm. They're trying to restore electricity now. 6,000 of the buildings have nothing left whatsoever to even try to restore service to. Another 50,000 buildings are damaged, and they have to redo the wiring internally or externally, and a few hundred have surviving wiring. So Tacloban was almost completely shattered, and you're talking a city of 500,000 people if you include temporary residents as well as those with permanent residency cards. Here's one of the less damaged parts of the airport. A lot of it, at least here you have the bars in the window and a couple of seats surviving, but parts of the airport, it was just totally, the walls were totally bashed out. These are people fleeing, trying to get on a plane. The airport was a somewhat chaotic scene, and particularly because the three prisons where the 1,100 convicts escaped from were all within walking distance of the airport. There was some concern about that. For example, there was a very sad case of a 12-year-old boy who may have been part of the looting at the local shopping mall about a couple miles from here. And he must have picked up something that somebody else more serious didn't like, because unfortunately they stabbed him once in the chest and then tore his throat open from ear to ear almost. And somehow, amazingly, he did survive. He was taken by other people there to an orphanage where people had medical care, medical experience, and they were able to get him out, even as other people like Richard Pulga, whom I interviewed at the hospital, all he had was a broken shin. He received no medical care for 5 days and died of blood infection. Not even topical anesthetic after the initial day of the injury. So here's more scenes of the airport. Here is people in one of the propeller planes that came in. One of the reasons, I ended up staying for 14 days in Tacloban straight. I was one of the last people to leave. And I did feel powerfully moved by this story because it was a very moving experience to be there, but I also felt as though I could make a difference. When I first arrived, I'm not somebody who's specialized in natural disasters or wars for the last 18 years like Tyler Hicks, or Sergei Ponomarev. We also flew in him from Moscow. There's somebody who spent 10 years covering Chechnya and every war in the Mideast. So, and again, tough as nails. Or Brian Denton, we also flew in him in from Beirut, 7 years covering Mideast wars. We viewed this as a combat assignment in many ways in terms of how to handle it. But I did have, oddly enough, a background in freight transportation, which is the first job I did at the New York Times. Which might not sound relevant, but one of the first things I looked at when I arrived at the airport, I thought, you know what, why is this airport such a mess in terms of the planes are not even properly parked? They're practically out on the tarmac. And I went and spoke to some air freight people and also Philippine Air Force officers and also and others and learned that they had no radar. All they were relying on was radioing planes when they came within range of their meager 10 miles. And here there was supposedly a relief effort. And the entire day, they only had 6 small propeller planes. But what was interesting was that one of them told me, he said, actually, 2 of them told me, the U.S. had a truck ready to go with a mobile air traffic control system, but couldn't bring it into Tacloban because they did not have a signed letter from the Philippine government. And I had a sat phone. I was lucky to be one of the few with a sat phone. So I emailed a detailed description of all of this to my colleagues at the who covered the Pentagon. And we also put it up on the web at the top of the front page. And within several hours, the Pentagon got the Philippine government's letter, and they had the truck there by dawn, or shortly after dawn the next morning. You couldn't do any air operations after dark. And they brought in lighting, and they went from 6 flights that day to 40 relief flights the next. So it really. There was a tremendous need for information in this situation. So I'll just, that's about it. Let me just quickly show you some of the other photos. You've probably seen many of them. Here are the bodies. This is, so just off the screen to the left is where the City Hall. It was such a chaotic situation that nobody could even get the bodies moved. And so the City Hall is where a number of us were working on laptops because there was a generator. We'd go around the town, we'd go back there and plug in there, and then go out. City Hall was a mess. While I was there, about 20 feet away, part of the ceiling began peeling down, and the person put his hands up, which protected him, and then it fell down on top of an Australian journalist because it was all so much water damage and so forth. But the smell from having 200 bodies rotting down the hill 50 yards from you was incredible. And yet, when they loaded them up, for example, the first time after, I think about day 6, they tried to move out the bodies. And there was gunfire on the city outskirts. This is all part of the instability. There was concerns. There was New People's Army, which is an insurgency on Leyte Island, I did not report that because I did not see that there was any evidence for it, and it never was confirmed, and it was making relief workers needlessly nervous and cautious. And what the other version was, which I credibly believed in, which they did say, was that it was... The gunfire was simply, people were shooting at looters, so you were hearing occasional gunfire as to try to try to ward off looters. So this is a heavily armed population, there was no evidence whatsoever of any guerrilla activity in any of this. So here is somebody, again, this is the lack of shelter problem. Here's a boy taking shelter from the rain. Here are people waiting for food. Once there was food to be distributed at all, which was not very often. Here are people beginning to replace things. I was deeply moved by the resilience of the Filipino people in trying to repair things. And here's somebody carrying a can of water. This is the road actually that went from City Hall to the hotel where we were staying at the beginning. That didn't have much there. And with that, thank you very much.
Power of journalism. I'd like to open it up to our audience. If you have a question, please raise your hands. I'm going to kick things off. If you can germinate, think about what you want to ask our guests, but I want to kick things off. And Christy, we heard from just the conditions there. What were some of the stories that you collected from your colleagues who were in some of the hardest hit areas as to just what, not only the working conditions, but trying to work through, stay credibly observant of the story, but still be so very much part of the story as well?
It was funny because I'll never forget when Andrew Stevens and Paula Hancock, they got back from Tacloban City to Manila, and you know, hugs and beers all around after they had their, as they said, much needed baths and showers. You know, the scene that I showed you from Tacloban City where Paula Hancock was, the picture of her and Paul Devitt, the cameraman, that was not far away from where a satellite dish was, and where the satellite dish was, 650 kilogram piece of equipment, turned into an outdoor latrine. So they were working, sleeping in that area. It was very, very filthy. And despite the harsh working conditions, the dead bodies, the devastation, when I asked Andrew Stevens what was the toughest thing that he had witnessed, he said it was when someone asked me for a bottle of water and I couldn't give it to him. He said that was the toughest thing for him covering the story. Just now, listening to Keith made me think of the stories of survival. From Manila, I interviewed the mayor's, the wife of the mayor of Tacloban City, who is a city councilor. And she told an incredible story of survival for her family when the rising water went into their home. Fortunately, she and her two daughters, they could swim. They ended up swimming up to the rafters of their home. And the father, the mayor of Tacloban City, had to punch a hole through the ceiling so then they would get extra air to breathe. And by holding onto the rafters, they were able to survive. Basically, they could swim and they were strong enough. But also what struck me about that story was this was the mayor of Tacloban City, and he had imperiled his family. The level of, I hate to use this word, but cluelessness just really struck me. That's why I said just the level of awareness. This is something that just needs to, we know that the Philippines, not a stranger at all to devastating typhoons. The Philippines, an archipelago of thousands of islands, experiences a number of typhoons every single year. This is going to happen again and again. Can there please be better awareness? Can there please be just a better plan in place so help can arrive?
Forecasting and mitigation, how could they have been dealt with better with hindsight?
I guess two separate questions. The forecasting wasn't necessarily that bad. The U.S. Navy was saying 185 mile per hour sustained winds, which is extraordinary if you think about it. When you hear in the United States of a Category 5 typhoon, or hurricane, that's anything over 155. And even Hurricane Katrina, while it reached 5 briefly over the Caribbean, came ashore as Category 2. So the fact this came ashore is not just a Category 5, but beyond any normal, the scale goes in 10 mile per hour increments, and then you've got 155, and then you got up this and up at 195. Now, some of the Philippine estimates were lower, but it was an enormously powerful storm. So to some extent, it was beyond what you could anticipate. I think the most important lesson in forecasting was don't use the word storm surge. Everybody knows the word tsunami. Yep. And people didn't understand when they were being told that there's a 10 or 20 foot, 10 foot plus storm surge, that meant that the whole ocean level, as opposed to some large waves, would go that high. In mitigation, I think that there were definite shortfalls in mitigation, but you have to remember that this was so far beyond what anybody could expect or deal with, that this was a really tough storm for any country to have responded to. I would use an example of Hurricane Andrew, 1992, and 4 days after the storm, you had people holding up signs saying, President Bush, please rescue us, please save us, because the U.S. didn't realize how bad the damage was. It's when you get something that is far beyond the usual, then it's very hard to recover. And as I was mentioning also, when you've got this, when you've got the damage so far inland to the point that there is no inland, it goes off the other side of the island, then goes and damages the next island without and barely slows down, then you've got a situation so horrible that it's very difficult to respond.
Florence de Changy was also there as a correspondent, and I want to invite her now to answer this question. Florence, when you got in there, were you prepared? How prepared were you? And was it hardly enough? And explain that.
No, not very much at all. And I can very briefly tell you a few little anecdotes. Actually, the first thing that shocked me, I arrived 48 hours after Keith. The difference was that I was alone. Not only alone, but no cell phone. So a bit like a tourist, really. And since there was very little feedback from the Tacloban zone, no one really knew what we were in for. And the first thing which struck me arriving at the airport was not the big issue that everyone was discussing, how many dead, is it 10,000, is it 5,000, but actually how come there are survivors. I was shocked to see living people because the scene was so like hell and the end of the world that I thought every survival was a miracle. So that was probably the first thing. And then later I started going around and I actually hitchhiked from a car to go into Tacloban, and we saw all these horrible pictures that you've seen, these bodies, the stench, you bump into something and suddenly, well, it's a dead body, and I mean all these things. And I remember at one stage, the heat was quite strong too, checking my watch and thinking like, okay, it's good enough. I've seen more in this time than in 20 years somewhere else. I probably can go. And I checked my watch and it was 9 o'clock. And I thought it must be 9 at night because I had the impression that so much, I had taken so much already. And actually I only arrived at 6 o'clock in the morning and it was still 9 o'clock in the morning. But it felt like a century had gone by and so many emotions and so many talking to people who all have horrible story one next to the other, that it took me a time to really ask. I teamed up with Japanese journalists, actually, to not be alone during that day trip. And we were amazed that time. So that was another anecdote. And maybe a final one is when we went back to the airport and it was complete chaos. So actually, I had no way out. It was my big struggle arriving in Cebu was to get in, and you can't afford to make sure you're going to be out. Your target is to get in. And Philippine Airlines was ridiculous. There was of course they had no computer, no electricity. They vaguely had paper written list of potential passenger. And my only hope with my Japanese friends who said, Florence, we have a spare ticket because I think his name was Sako, could not join us. It was the fourth. I said, no problem, I can be called Sako considering the control that is happening in here. Anything will do, you know. And anyway, we even didn't make it on this official flight. And I ended up leaving during the night with some refugees. But before that, around 5 or 6, I saw one U.S. Army guy and a very nice guy, Staff Sergeant Clark. Maybe you got to know him. And I just went to him and I said, I'm sorry, can I interrupt 1 second? This is complete chaos like I've never seen in other disaster zones. What are you doing? These kids dying in front of you. No one has got a drop of water. And he tells me, excuse me, ma'am, let me explain. I am based in Mindanao. I was sent on Sunday here to re-establish a communication with my 5 men. We are 6. We arrived on Sunday for 1 mission, re-establish communication. The first thing I did was, like Keith did, you know, calling not the Pentagon, but calling whoever he had to call and saying a typical American style, you know, we have a situation. So according to him, the disaster, the size of the disaster was initially underestimated for the simple reason that the communication was not coming through. And he said, guys, start moving. And by the time they send the aircraft carrier and all that, then it started going on. But all these little things added up to aggravate, I guess, the disaster.
One small point on that. The Interior Secretary of the Philippines and the head of the National Disaster Recovery Agency were both in Tacloban, went down there before the typhoon, and the Philippine government lost contact with both of them because they didn't have a sat phone. So they could not even get word out on whether they were okay, like Andrew Stevens and others. So it was anybody who didn't have a sat phone was really stuck in terms of having no communications, and the Philippine government doesn't have a lot of sat phone accounts. Began orthoria.
Keith, back to one of your earlier comments about lessons learned. What about, you know, we know that the militaries in the whole in the region do joint exercises all the time for disaster relief, not just the United States. What was the when the chips were down? How do the other regional countries respond to this interactively or one-on-one with the Philippine government?
The Chinese government famously offered $100,000, which provoked a lot of criticism, and that was days later. Of all the groups that made the biggest difference, it was actually a nonprofit, the Tzu Chi Foundation, based in Taiwan, made a huge difference. That's a nonprofit, it's a Buddhist group. I'll never forget the numbers I was given by the city administrator about 2 weeks after the storm. I was still there then, and he said, well, you know, we're still trying to dig out, and we have 50 dump trucks as we try to remove the equivalent of, it was the equivalent of covering dozens of football fields 30 feet deep, because everywhere was debris. We have 50 dump trucks, and out of those 50, as I recall, two had survived that belonged to the city. And there were several from the Philippines Red Cross, and there were several from the national government, and a couple from elsewhere. And there were 39 dump trucks from Tzu Chi Foundation. They also played a role in the doing their pay-for-work program. They got started faster even than international relief groups than practically anybody else. They were paying 500 pesos in a place where the minimum wage was 300 pesos for a day's work. They didn't try to monitor it. They trusted you to enroll that morning, go spend your day trying to clean things up, and they'd give you 500 pesos in the evening. That also helped restore buying power, which meant that to the extent that food and water did start flowing into the area, people could afford it. And that that was really a successful program. There's been a general move in development and disaster relief towards trying to just send in cash and then let the local population try to see if they can get aid in. But one of the key lessons was you've got to have security. So I was... I remember talking to the Philippine Red Cross right after I arrived, and they were sort of mourning or unhappy that they had sent actually a dozen truckloads of relief supplies that were supposed to reach Tacloban before the typhoon. They didn't because the storm got there faster than they expected. And then they couldn't get it into Tacloban because there was gangs or crowds of people who tried to hijack and loot the trucks for supplies, and they had to turn back. They didn't reach there until several days later with all these medical supplies that were really needed, food, water, and even when they did reach there, they were not able to bring in a gasoline tanker, even though everybody was just sort of paralyzed on the ground. We were using mountain bikes and hiking everywhere for days before we finally were able to buy that 7.5 gallons of fuel for $300 US, and that was what allowed us to go into the interior with the truck, which is basically, yeah, we parked the moment we arrived at the hotel because it was just didn't even have any fumes left. So if you don't have security, then you can't do much of anything. And so having a big, immediate, large security presence really helps.
Also, looking back at the USAID response, I thought was very impressive. The United States was among the first, if not the first, to answer that international appeal that the Philippines government issued out with USAID, the U.S. military stepping up relief. Remember the USS George Washington setting sail from Hong Kong, going there to provide much-needed runway space for all the aid to get in. U.S. Marines showing up on the ground to Tacloban City to help power up the runways because there was no power and they needed to make it a 24/7 operation. And also, I thought the timing was a bit uncanny because it happened just weeks after President Obama canceled his trips to ASEAN and to APEC, and a number of allies were probably questioning the relationship with the U.S. And that, unfortunately, it took a disaster for them to see both the soft power, or rather the military power of the U.S. be able to assist in a time of need.
It was such a relief. The presence, you almost couldn't look up by about day 7 or 8 without seeing a U.S. aircraft somewhere. There were so many Ospreys and U.S. helicopters in operation, particularly after the carrier task force showed up. And that had a transformational effect, because this was beyond the ability of the Philippines to handle alone. And everybody in Tacloban was so grateful to the United States.
I have to ask permission of our audience. I would love to ask you if you'd like to extend beyond the 2 o'clock for those of you who cannot stay. Please don't feel like we're keeping you, and if you have to go, go. But I do see a number of hands in the audience, and I'd like to take a couple of more questions. So I will start actually back there. I saw that first, and thank you.
I guess this question's for Keith, because you touched on this a bit. I was sort of helping a humanitarian aid organization who was one of the first responders in an international organization. And they reported that aid workers are being killed. And you just you sort of touched on the looting of the Red Cross trucks. So I want to ask you, sort of as a journalist in that situation, how do you balance sort of covering the whole story and protecting aid workers and kind of ensuring that help is still getting in? So it's sort of balancing two, you know, kind of competing demands.
I think every aid group, like every news organization, has to be constantly assessing what the situation looks like. I'm not aware of any aid workers who were actually killed, and I think it was very important to try to separate the rumors from the facts. That's why the day of that report, people claiming it was New People's Army was a dilemma. But there was no evidence that it was them. That was what people were saying to each other. Oh, well, there's gunfire on the city perimeter. It must be New People's Army. Well, that's not enough to meet a standard of proof. And certainly there were lots of other people who had guns. So why would you think it was them? But I think that... I think the safest place to be was the airport, because it did have the military presence. Now, the crowds were so large that you didn't know who was next to you in the crowds of refugees. So that was, and my military presence, we're talking at first a few dozen people, which is not much, but it certainly grew. I think that... that it was just sort of a constant balance. To give you an example, the hotel that we moved to downtown, which at least had the advantage of being a shelter, had no security whatsoever. And there was, when we arrived there, we heard that one room had been looted. There were no soldiers, no guards, no nothing. And it would be a potentially attractive target. The Philippine Red Cross began putting some people in there a couple of days later. And the husband of one of them was a Philippines Army major, and he took the initiative to organize the staff and handed out whistles to them and had them take turns standing at the four corners. This is an outdoor hotel kind of thing where you can walk among the various buildings, so it's with no fence either. He took the initiative of distributing whistles, and he said, well, if you hear a whistle, then grab the nearest stick and run towards that location and try to confront who it is, whoever it might be. And I was certainly, I was in some cases almost up till dawn, because we were very lucky to have a full moon, so that was great. And the moon was getting fuller through that first week. So we started with a quarter moon and moved up to, and so that was nice. So you could work by moonlight, and I was working outdoors because my room was smelled so horrible, but also because it allowed my battery life to last longer. And so I was like, you just had to keep your ears open for it. And I think that's what aid workers were doing too, was keeping their aid workers. There were some aid workers who little by little ended up at the same hotel. So it was initially kind of deserted, and then more and more ended up there. And I think people were sort of looking out for each other too. I think that with hindsight, or not even with hindsight, the fact is the people of Tacloban are wonderful, wonderful, friendly people. And so they were, there were a lot of rumors, but you just had to be, take them with a grain of salt.
Right over here.
Thanks, Keith and Christy. This was not long ago, I mean, what is the current state of Tacloban now? You know, what is the current state of coverage? Is it at the level you guys are happy with? Or do we run the risk of people forgetting about this? And will you guys go back, keep the story alive?
I think we definitely had plans to go back, and we continue to keep tabs on the story. It was just about a couple weeks ago when we were looking at the situation in Guian. It's one of the hard-hit areas in the disaster zone, because it had been hit with another storm. And we did report on air that as a result of what happened there, Oxfam was making another appeal for an additional 400,000 temporary shelters, because people had lost their temporary shelters and needed replacement for that. Because this, I mean, the story is not over yet. I mean, additional challenges are coming in. Just to touch on what Florence was mentioning earlier about the sheer number of survivors is stunning, but it's also 3.9 million people who've lost everything. You know, their homes, their livelihoods, their schools, their hospitals, their power infrastructure, and 4 million people, that's almost more than half the population all of Hong Kong. It's gonna take a long time for them to build back. I know there's a lot of discussion among aid groups if they can build back stronger and build back better, because this was already an impoverished community. Could this be a window of opportunity for them to build homes that are more stormproof in an area that is prone to many typhoons, to build back a sustainable industry that could bring prosperity to this group of people? Keith was just there. I'd love to hear more about what he saw. And unfortunately, what you reported on was just especially an economy in tatters.
It's still in bad shape. I did my fourth trip there 2 weeks ago. And the on the one hand, I think that the aid groups have done wonderful work in terms of bringing food, water supplies, medical. The first week was horrific, and into the second week as well, but it has gotten much better in terms of the immediate needs. In terms of rebuilding the place, though, it is a huge challenge. It's proving very slow to try to build new housing. It's expensive. There are a lot of people who don't want to leave their homes or even squatter sites that are within 40 meters of the ocean. And so that's proving very difficult. The government has tried to put a lot of tents into those areas, because at least the tents mean that that's not a permanent structure, and maybe you can move people afterwards instead of having them actually rebuild and feel as though they have something that they want to hold on to. Of course, with a storm surge that goes a mile inland, clearing a 40-meter coastal strip doesn't necessarily solve all your problems, but at least it's a beginning. But that said, particularly there are places in Tacloban that are not going to have electricity for a year. They're having to, it's as though they were building the electricity system in a place that never had one. They're saying we're having to re-electrify from scratch. And that's hurting the economic recovery. Some places have done good work in terms of distributing seeds. Tanawan, I was talking to the mayor of Tanawan a couple weeks ago, and so it's Tacloban, Palo, and then Tanawan. And they actually do have a rice crop into the ground, which is good. So there'll be food there. The toughest dilemma is what to do with the city of Tacloban, where they don't have something they can plant. They don't have sort of the food available in rural areas. And the fishing boats were sunk. There are too many people buying fishing boats actually now for them. What they really need is to rebuild a whole economy, rather, because they had an overfishing problem prior to the storm.
I'm going to just take two more questions, and then we'll, right over here, please. Yeah.
Hi, I'm a Filipino journalist. I'm based in Hong Kong, and I'd just like to maybe point out a bit about what Christy said earlier about the awareness level. I don't know whether you're aware, the president of the Philippines did go on air the night before to tell people to evacuate, and what usually happens in these places, even, you know, in face of an imminent volcanic eruption, for example, they don't want to leave. And what happened with the Tacloban mayor was a very good example. He didn't pay attention. He brought his staff nearer to the sea in the city hall, left his family behind in the mansion. So that's what happened. The family had to, like, try to survive on their own, because the father of the family was decided to go closer to shore. So it's always in hindsight, obviously, that people become aware that this is something you don't, you know, you have to take seriously. Because the president himself went on air to warn people to leave, and that often happens, but most of them don't. And as Keith just pointed out as well, that even now that they're being told not to rebuild closer to shore, they still insist on doing it. It's very difficult. So, but apart from that, CNN got a bit of flack. Anderson Cooper, I think out of frustration, was reporting that there was no effort being made to retrieve the bodies. It all balanced out in the end. A lot of Filipinos actually did agree with him, but there was also flack because people thought this is something that was not, you know, anticipated. So it was very difficult for a lot of people to respond to it immediately. My question is, how do you balance your own personal feelings? Because it's going to be very difficult being in such a place where so many terrible things are happening right before your eyes. How do you balance it with reporting, sending out the correct information? Keith mentioned something about ignoring the thing about the gunfight, which turned out to be a very good decision. But in terms of actually feeling what's happening and then reporting, trying to report objectively, how do you balance this out? Thank you very much.
By just reporting what you know. I mean, for example, and letting the audience come to a conclusion, which, of course, the audience and our viewership are perfectly well able to do that. An example of that is just by, for example, when I conducted the interview with the city councilor, the wife of the mayor of Tacloban, and hearing her account of how she and her family were in harm's way, even though there were the warnings out there, I think that speaks for itself. And then interviewing a Cebu city official on how they heard about the warnings in advance, and evacuations did take place there. I think people could see and hear the discrepancy between these two places and how they were managed and come to a conclusion themselves. But I think, you know, as a journalist, you have to focus on the concrete detail and the facts stand for themselves. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to leave it there. Of course, these are just some of the stories, but there are dozens more like them. Florence, thank you for sharing your anecdotes. You were there as well. Christy and Keith, thank you for sharing your time and the stories behind the extraordinary coverage that we saw from the New York Times and CNN, along with so many others. You're just a handful of the dozens of colleagues who flooded into the region to tell the story. To you three, to all our correspondents in the field who braved extenuating circumstances, at times with no regard to yourselves, to tell the stories of those most in need, to let the world know your reporting did save lives. Thank you for your work, and I want to thank the audience, to you, for supporting journalism. Thank you so much. Before I let my guests go, a gift from the FCC.